Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Have you ever thought much about time travel, like on your own, beyond what's in movies, TV, or books? For me, I've often daydreamed about going back in time. Of course I have. I'm a history guy. But also, wouldn't it be amazing to become some worshipped celebrity genius just because you brought back with you some ordinary modern idea like germ theory, the concept of zero, even double-entry bookkeeping would have been transformative. But then there's the trouble of A, avoiding being burned at the stake for witchcraft, and B, actually communicating the idea. These concepts seem pretty basic to us, but they often rely on enormous amounts of surrounding context that would be missing. And if you go far enough back, you're going to have real trouble with the language, too. Not only will it be foreign, but the entire mode of thinking might be different. It'd be like talking to aliens. Same thing for traveling forward in time. Set your time machine to the year 10,026, and do you really think you'd be able to have a conversation with whatever human hybrid AI cyborg creature is living then? But this is a real problem that real people are trying to solve, because there are some things we need to tell these human hybrid AI cyborg creatures, like, hey, this whole area here, yeah, it's a radioactive waste dump, stay away. That's the conundrum being investigated on today's Saturday Matinee in an episode from the podcast American Hysteria, and I hope you enjoy. While you're listening, be sure to search for and follow American Hysteria. We put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
On this podcast, we explore fantastical thinking, moral panics, urban legends, conspiracy theories, hoaxes, and crazes, examine the forces that shape our culture, and tell the stories that create the realities we share, and sometimes the realities we don't. I'm your host, Chelsea Weber Smith, and this is American Hysteria.
We are accustomed in this country to act only in times of crisis. But with nuclear waste, when the crisis comes, it will be too late.
Throughout the day, chaos and confusion reigned as monitors tried to determine exactly how much radiation was released.
We could be creating a radioactive waste monster with no cage to keep it in.
Let's say it's 10,000 years in the future, and America is unrecognizable, as far from the reality we know today as 10,000 years ago was to those who lived in the 21st century. I imagine myself wandering through the New Mexico desert, scouting for scant resources like it's an apocalyptic video game. The sun violently hot and bright, while I'm wearing a silver suit and goggles, and yes, hoping I still look cute. Most wealthy people have already left for the climate-controlled colonies on Mars, leaving behind those who can't or won't abandon the Earth we love. But despite the unimaginable conditions we live under, I assume I am still as dangerously curious as I am today. In the distance, shimmering like a mirage, I see something. Something huge that seems straight out of one of those primitive pieces of folklore that they called Disney movies, a massive forest of something that comes into focus with each step I take. I can just make it out, a massive tangle of enormous stone thorns and the angry, crooked shadows they cast. A wind hits me gently, and a mournful howl rises up all around me, but I can't see where it's coming from. That's when I notice the large monoliths, one of many, that seem to guard the area like solemn monks. Behind the scrawlings of graffiti and the patches of dead moss are ancient messages. The many languages are foreign to me, lost to time, under the date 2028, now 10,000 years in the past. I can make out some of what they once called English, a language used on this land that now only the scholastically dedicated are able to make any sense of. Luckily, I was put in advanced classes as a kid, and I learned how to struggle through English nursery rhymes from thousands of years ago. It takes time, but I'm able to slowly understand what I think is some kind of long-lost poem. This place is a message, and part of a system of messages. Pay attention to it. Sending this message was important to us. We considered ourselves to be a powerful culture. This place is not a place of honor. No highly esteemed deed is commemorated here. Nothing valued is here. What is here was dangerous and repulsive to us. This message is a warning about danger. The danger is in a particular location. It increases toward a center. The center of danger is here, of a particular size and shape, and below us. The danger is still present in your time as it was in ours. The danger is to the body, and it can kill. The form of the danger is an emanation of energy. The danger is unleashed only if you substantially disturb this place physically. This place is best shunned and left uninhabited. Now, suddenly, I'm crying. I don't know exactly why. The message cuts into my very heart, like something that's lived in my DNA for centuries without my conscious knowledge. That's when two cats wind themselves through the thorns to meet my despair, rubbing their bodies against my shins and purring. But there's something wrong with these cats, something I've never seen before in my life. They are bright green and almost glowing. In school, I had read the legends of the old ones who lived here, the ones about the green cats. A short poem we played clapping games to, skipped rope to. Where the cats are green, the earth is mean. Death comes to those who do not heed. It's very clear now that something bad is inside the forest of enormous thorns. I know I should not go into the forest of enormous thorns with ominous warnings guarded by mythical green cats. But of course, I go into the forest of enormous thorns with the same glee and hubris I would have gone 10,000 years ago into an abandoned sanatorium plastered with no trespassing signs, labeled condemned. As I walk, my feet strike an enormous black slab of stone that covers the entire earth below. When I get to the center, it's clear that someone has drilled deep into it, the chaos of broken stone gathered around the massive hole. I step to the threshold and stare down into the black. There must be something incredible down there. All day long, I sit by the hole, obsessed with whatever must lie at the bottom. I want it so bad. I want to know so bad. And that, dear listeners, is how I am infected with radiation poisoning from ancient nuclear waste. You see, these things were important warnings, dire warnings. This forest of thorns, this ominous howl, these monoliths, these green cats, this huge black slab. They were placed by people in the 21st century over a deep cavern of used plutonium, byproducts of a primitive society's global death wish and of their desire for more and more energy to power their ancient cities. In our present time, we've struggled with the fact that nuclear waste has a half-life of more than 20,000 years. This has led to the question, could nuclear waste be as dangerous to those 10,000 years in the future as it is to us today? If so, how do we warn our distant descendants to avoid the sites where we've left it all behind? 10,000 years ago, humans had just discovered agriculture. Would those people have been able to communicate messages to us? When our languages, when our cultural symbols, when our methods of conveying information inevitably change drastically or disappear completely, how do we talk to the future? Those involved in addressing these questions are part of a bizarre field known as nuclear semiotics, a discipline which didn't really exist before 1981. Semiotics is the study of signs and symbols, how they're used inside a culture, and how meaning is made from them. The examples I gave in the introduction are just a handful of the ways that government-sponsored physicists, behavioral scientists, linguists, engineers, lawyers, anthropologists, science fiction authors, folklorists, and artists have tried to solve this theoretical puzzle of protecting the humans of our far-flung future. This episode is a story told in a series of strangely poetic reports commissioned by the U.S. government and nuclear power corporations. A story of offbeat academics trying to talk to the future and given free rein to get real weird with it. But first, as always, let's set the cultural scene. That's right after this.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
And now, back to the show.
The Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid many fold, and the end is not yet. With this bomb, we have now added a new and revolutionary increase in destruction to supplement the growing power of our armed forces. In their present form, these bombs are now in production, and even more powerful forms are in development. It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East.
In 1945, after two atomic bombs had leveled entire communities and horrifically killed around 200,000 civilian human beings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, everyday Americans had become acutely aware not only of the earth-shattering power of these unimaginable weapons, but also the unstudied danger of their lasting radiation. As the Soviet Union and the United States became locked in an arms race and the threat of the Cold War was ever present in the news, popular culture began reflecting these anxieties, whether it be the comic superheroes made super through the mutating effects of radiation, or the atomic sci-fi and horror movie monsters, or the eerie Twilight Zone commentaries. Americans were also made aware of the strange tests being conducted using fake towns and mannequin families, trying to measure the true danger of an atomic blast.
Now, for civil defense, another realistic test is held. In a two-story house on Main and Elm Streets, a mannequin family waits, 3,500 feet from atomic destruction. They're lifeless dummies, but to the civil defense officials testing bomb shelters, they could help save lives. A second home stands a mile away. America is seeking through these drills to strengthen home front defenses, for their strength means our safety.
In the 50s and 60s, the government tried its best to put a cute face on nuclear war, featuring hip displays at Sears of fashionable products for your own personal underground bomb shelter, which all Americans were encouraged to build under the green, green grass of their own backyards. Officials commissioned cute cartoon videos for kids about how to protect themselves from an atomic explosion.
He's duck and cover, duck and cover.
He did what we all must learn to do.
You and you
and you
and you. Duck and cover.
Be sure and remember what Bert the Turtle just did, friends, because every one of us must remember to do the same thing. That's what this film is all about. Duck and cover.
This is an official civil defense film produced...
Soon, there bloomed a patriotic message that nuclear was the future. Nuclear power was rising as a profitable industry that could provide massive amounts of energy for the American population. And mega corporations, in tandem with the government, started another cheery campaign to soothe the masses back into support for these science-based solutions, again using the magic of propagandistic cartoons.
This man, like thousands of others around the country, is suffering from a dread disease called nucleosis. The symptoms? Nuclear blindness. All he can see is a mushroom cloud. He is blinded from the fear of it, deaf from the sound of it. There is a short circuit in his brain. He can only think of the awfulness of the nuclear bomb.
Truly, the superpower which man has released from within the atom's heart is not one, but many giants. One is the warrior, the destroyer. Another is the engineer, seeking to provide vast quantities of energy to run the world's machines. On man's wisdom, on his firmness in the use of that power, depends now the future of his children and his children's children in the new world of the atomic age.
But there was a major problem that needed to be addressed. The nuclear byproducts from creating those weapons and that new form of energy would last for tens of thousands of years, longer than the entire history of human civilization. Through the last 80 years, we've considered burying our nuclear waste deep in the ocean floor, or shooting it into space, even straight into the sun. The National Academy of Sciences eventually decided that the waste should be buried deep in a salt mine, void of any groundwater, so that, over time, the salt would pack itself around the waste and entomb it completely. By the 1970s, Yucca Mountain, located 80 miles north of Las Vegas, was chosen as the nation's future high-level waste repository, and construction plans started to move forward to dig a great cavern that would, in theory, protect Americans and the world at large for centuries or millennia to come.
It will start with a tremor in a nuclear power plant. Where it will end will depend on three people.
I would say you're probably lucky to be alive. Same for the rest of Southern California.
I don't know that accident is the right word.
Accident is the right word!
The China Syndrome. Today, only a handful of people know what it really means. And they're scared.
Everybody keep your station! Everybody keep your station!
Soon, you will know.
And then, in 1979, amidst ongoing environmental and anti-war activism against weapons of mass destruction and the dangers of nuclear radiation, a critically acclaimed disaster movie hit hundreds of theaters across the country, grossing an impressive $4.3 million in its first weekend alone. The China Syndrome, starring Jane Fonda, Michael Douglas, and Jack Lemmon, follows a news reporter and her cameraman as they discover a conspiratorial cover-up of major safety issues at an LA nuclear power plant, and then are hunted down by powerful forces when they try to reveal the truth. If you're wondering about the title, China Syndrome refers to the dramatized metaphor of a nuclear meltdown in which the waste escapes underground structures and burns through the earth all the way to China. This movie truly pissed off executives of nuclear power companies, and 2 days after the film's release, the New York Times compiled some of their responses. These guys felt that it was a totally out-of-line plot, and according to Vice President John Taylor of the megacorporation Westinghouse Electric, quote,
"An overall character assassination of an entire industry."
The nuclear research engineer for the Commonwealth Edison Company, David Rosen, oversaw 7 reactors, with another 6 in the process of being built. He made this statement to the Times.
"Frankly, I don't believe a serious accident could ever happen. I'm a scientist, and I don't believe in zeros. But I do believe in redundant systems and the capability of people and systems to take preventive action."
But then, just 10 days after this article was published, and 12 days after the premiere of The China Syndrome, the worst nuclear power industry accident in U.S. history occurred at a plant in Pennsylvania.
"An unexpected release of more radiation today from the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant has led to a series of consequences.
Throughout the day, chaos and confusion reigned as monitors tried to determine exactly how much radiation was released. But at a news conference early this afternoon, Governor Thornburg suggested pregnant women and preschool children within a 5-mile radius of Three Mile Island leave the area. And residents within a 10-mile radius have been urged to stay indoors indefinitely.
On March 28, 1979, a series of malfunctions at the Three Mile Island plant led to a release of radioactive gases into the surrounding area. after the totally unprepared local government and power company sent mixed messages about the levels of danger and the actions locals should take, they made their own decision to flee, jamming their cars full of their belongings and mobbing banks to withdraw cash. To prepare for the possible health fallouts from the meltdown, hospitals turned away anyone but emergency patients. Eventually, 40% of people in a 15-mile radius chose to evacuate as priests began granting general absolution to the remaining people in their congregations, which is a general blanket forgiveness of sin, usually only performed in war zones. Despite the public's panicked reaction, no one was actually killed or hurt during the accident. Around 2 million of those living near the reactor were exposed to some level of nuclear radiation, though so far, according to government reports, that exposure has not yielded any negative health effects, though other recent studies have suggested that local cancer levels may have risen. Whatever the truth is, the impact at that time on citizen opinion, corporate entities, and the government was immense. Stricter safety regulation legislation was passed, leading to expensive changes in plant design, so much so that companies no longer felt that nuclear power was as profitable as it was before, and the construction of new facilities slowed considerably. It also had a profound effect on the U.S. public's opinion of nuclear power, with overall support falling drastically from 69% in 1977 to 46% following the 1979 meltdown. In addition to the many other demonstrations in cities all over the country, an estimated 200,000 anti-nuclear activists showed up in New York City to protest shortly after the disaster, an event which included speeches by independent politician Ralph Nader and star of the China Syndrome herself, Jane Fonda. At the same time, a No Nukes concert series was put on by Musicians United for Safe Energy at Madison Square Garden. Here's a word now from musician Jackson Brown.
What's wrong is that one of the things wrong is that there's no way of disposing of the high-level nuclear waste. It's probably the most serious threat to the genetic chain and to life on the planet that has ever been posed.
A year later, journalists began breaking stories about the 100,000 downwinders, those medically affected by the radiation from nuclear bomb tests and nuclear power accidents. And later lawsuits forced the Department of Energy to reveal that the air and water around many different sites, like Hanford, Washington, had been contaminated. It turned out that the American Energy Commission knew about the potential adverse health effects of radiation long before they told the American public and had actively suppressed and even lied about the evidence. Not only that, but a People magazine article in 1980 told the story of the 1956 Hollywood blunder, The Conqueror, starring John Wayne and Susan Hayward, which was filmed near St. George, Utah. Despite assurances that they would not be harmed by radiation from the active nuclear bomb tests happening 100 miles away, John Wayne, Susan Hayward, and 91 of the 220 cast and crew members were eventually diagnosed with various cancers. Though it's unlikely that radiation was the main factor in these illnesses, the possibility that it could have had a hand in the death of two of the most beloved movie stars of all time didn't help the prospects of a docile nuclear future.
Good evening. On this Earth Day, millions of Americans in the communities which dot this map have taken the first step to survival. But if this day of teach-ins, mock funerals, rallies, marches, speeches, and songs does not convince enough of us that the threat to our life on Earth is clear and present, then we may have cast a vote for death.
These students admit that the conducting of a funeral service to point up the problems of pollution may be overstating the case. But they also point out that pollution, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder. And it is also in the ear, nose, throat, and bloodstream. And that is why today the people of Ashtabula are mourning the deaths of children yet unborn.
Environmental activism had been a major movement in the 1970s, and more people were looking at our treatment of the natural world with horror, asking what this greed-driven devastation would mean for our children and our children's children and our children's children's children. Soon after the PR disaster that was the Three Mile Island meltdown, the U.S. Department of Energy, along with the nuclear power corporation Bechtel, formed the Human Interference Task Force to address the issue of potential radiation poisoning and the need for long-term nuclear waste storage. They gathered together American and European academics of many different and surprising disciplines to participate in a baffling thought experiment: how to communicate with a society that had advanced 10,000 years. They started with the obvious, designing warning markers that would provide simplified information in all the major world languages. But those on the task force also knew that these languages would likely be obsolete long before the 10,000-year mark, just as many that were spoken even a few hundred years ago are now impossible to decipher for anyone other than the most dedicated scholars. Since it's impossible to know if our languages will be better preserved and taught to the masses eons in the future, the task force tried to agree instead on simple universal symbols that could stand this test of time. The skull and crossbones was considered, as it's long represented poisonous danger in the Western world, but also speaks just as loudly to the idea of pirates and buried treasure, not a mixed message that the DOE wanted to impart. They made comic-like panels of a human stick figure opening a nuclear barrel, getting sick, and dying. But they realized that different cultures read images and words from right to left, or up and down, or down and up, and they could accidentally make it look like opening a barrel could bring the dead back to life. So they sketched crude cartoon faces, including one modeled after the painting The Scream to express horror, and another that attempted to show nausea but looked more like someone who just sucked on a lemon. Though perhaps more reliable than language, even facial expressions can mean different things cross-culturally, not to mention in the span of thousands of years. So the Human Interference Task Force became open to more unorthodox proposals.
When all the other gods had given gifts to Pandora, Zeus gave his own present, a box. He told Pandora that she was never, ever to open it. But Pandora was not happy. Every day, she wondered what was inside the box that Zeus had given her. One day, when she was all alone, Pandora could hold it no longer. She just had to have a look. But as soon as she lifted the lid of the box, out flew every kind of trouble in the world. Greed, lies, sickness, death, war, and more.
The ancient Greek myth of Pandora's box was written during the 7th century BC, about 2,700 years ago, a cautionary tale that survived through a multitude of cultures and into the present day. Pandora and her proverbial box appears as an emblem of misery and destruction. With this in mind, semiotician and linguist Thomas Sebeok put forth his idea to use the lasting power of ritual, myth, and folk memory to create another potent story that could last thousands of years. For this 10-millennia plan, an elite group of professionals would become the keepers of nuclear knowledge, a chosen few with access to the full truth about these ominous sites. The information, according to Sebeok, quote, would be entrusted exclusively to, what we might call for dramatic emphasis, an atomic priesthood, that is, a commission of knowledgeable physicists, experts in radiation sickness, anthropologists, linguists, psychologists, semioticians, and whatever additional expertise may be called for now and in the future. He said there would be a kind of relay system that would allow the information to be passed down from academic generation to academic generation through an ongoing nomination process. As is clear from the name, the atomic priesthood would be modeled after the Catholic Church's structure that had allowed special knowledge to be held and passed down for going on 2,000 years. Due to the possible terrorist threat posed by bad actors willing to use these materials buried at these sites for nefarious ends, Sebeok's atomic priesthood would not be able to be straightforward about the true dangers or exact locations of these repositories. Instead, they would be responsible for creating and spreading myths and superstitions, urban legends that would keep people away from these sites, the way our various boogeymen have long kept children out of the woods. It was suggested that the threat of some kind of spiritual retribution for trespassing on these sites could be spread through religious warnings, which, if designed correctly, could stick in the public consciousness for thousands of years to come. However, critics pointed out that giving dangerous secret knowledge to an elite few could lead, almost inevitably, I would say, to the group using this knowledge to amass power instead of valiantly protecting their fellow human beings. But the idea of creating intentional long-term lore was part of other proposals as well. Beyond the obvious, the tried and true cautionary tales that could be carefully manufactured, philosophers François Bastide and Paulo Fabri expanded the idea into creating living, breathing folklore. The creature eventually known as the radiation cat or the ray cat would be genetically engineered using bioluminescence so that it would actually change color when it got close enough to radioactivity. Anthropologists have found evidence that the relationship between humans and domesticated cats began between 10 and 12,000 years ago, and considering how cats remain animal gods today, they may very well be our close companions in another 10,000 years. These living radiation detectors, as the philosophers called them, would be immortalized through folk tales and folk songs that could stand the test of deep time if they were catchy enough. Though not taken seriously as an option by the U.S. government, this idea has become the most beloved of the possibilities considered, and I highly recommend you check out the 2014 episode of the 99% Invisible podcast called 10,000 Years. where they tried to commission the catchiest song that they could about our darling Ray Cat, an earworm that could stand the test of deep time. Similar to the Ray Cat, the concept of information plants was put forth by Polish sci-fi author Stanisław Lem, who envisioned planting near the site a biologically altered flora species with warnings written into its very DNA, codes which could only be deciphered by scientific experts. But that presents a pretty serious issue in itself. What with cross-pollination and genetic mutations, and of course the question of why the fuck anyone would look at plant DNA for a secret message. His next idea felt at least somewhat in the realm of possibility. Launch long-term satellites into the sky that would beam nuclear information down. But how that would really work was anyone's guess, considering that our most advanced satellites are unlikely to last more than a few hundred years. Plus, there would still be the issue of how to communicate the information to an advanced society where our languages and symbols are long lost. Physicist Philip Sontag offered up the idea of an artificial moon, which would be engraved all over its surface with warnings in various language and pictograms, similar to the ones that we've discussed. But the fake moon, which would have to be kept in the sky by a satellite, would be difficult to fuel for 10,000 years. Not only would the code written on the moon face all the same problems of long-term communication, but its message would also have to be large enough to be visible to scientists and governments. So it really seems like a lot more trouble than it's worth. But as a poet, I respect the longing for a second moon. This report was updated several years later when the proposed Yucca Mountain Repository faced opposition from environmental activists as well as the Nevada government and members of the Western Shoshone tribe who considered the mountain a sacred site. The federal government then moved its focus to the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, about 26 miles from Carlsbad, New Mexico. Continuing their vision for the long-term nuclear warning system, they focused this time on creating a landscape around the site, which would convey, quote, a place of great foreboding. With the knowledge that written and pictorial messages would likely degrade over time, both physically and linguistically, the site itself needed to convey a strong sense of potential doom. In addition to that forest of massive thorns I mentioned before, ideas for what they called menacing earthworks, my new band name, were put forward as ways to communicate a kind of timeless danger. One proposal, complete with creepy sketches, was to create a field of giant spikes, pointed chaotically in different directions, appearing to burst out from broken ground. Another idea was to create massive lightning-shaped mounds of dirt that appeared to be shooting out from a center point where the underground waste is stored. They thought of creating that huge basalt or concrete slab that would prevent anyone from being able to dig or farm in that location without going to great lengths to burrow through it. Referred to as the black hole, a riff on this concept was to create a dark masonry slab that would absorb and radiate back the heat from the desert sun, creating an extremely hot area totally intolerable to humans. They got even more symbolic when they thought of approximating the feeling that something had been destroyed using dynamite to blow up a bunch of huge rocks into rubble all over the site. making the vibe more post-apocalyptic, they thought of building hundreds of black stone blocks the size of houses and arranging them so that it appeared to have once been a creepy town with these abandoned streets that lead to nowhere. It was also suggested that structures be built around the area that, when wind passes through them, would create dissonant and mournful sounds that would add to that feeling of foreboding. More after this.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
And now, back to the show.
The life cycle of a nuclear weapon system is dependent on a successful development and operational test and evaluation program. Sandia National Laboratories is continuing to make substantial improvements to its already extensive, highly specialized testing and evaluation range instrumentation capabilities.
Before the waste isolation pilot plant could officially start accepting high-level waste, Congress, as well as the Environmental Protection Agency, made it necessary to continue the thought experiment, which they did in a 1991 project that culminated in the Sandia Report, put out by the Sandia National Laboratories. But this time, instead of trying to figure out how to warn future humans, a task force made up of 16 experts, including physicists, political scientists, and lawyers, were asked to imagine the cultural conditions that might end up disturbing the sites and releasing radiation throughout the coming centuries and millennia. While most of the groups who worked on the team were assigned to predict more logical versions of deep time using data and graphs and flowcharts, the Southwest team, made up of futurist Theodore J. Gordon, lawyer Michael Barham, physicist Bernard Cohen, and sociologist Wendell Bell, were encouraged to think outside the nuclear box and come up with 10 different unorthodox visions of the future. The question they posed was,
what if phenomena that are deviant or only a mere idea today become dominant, the norm, the realities of tomorrow?
And so they purposefully came up with the most
outlandish, irrational, perverse, and repugnant
scenarios and claimed that
thinking the unthinkable is part of our task.
Their handful of future predictions were included in the Sandia Report, and here are a few of the visions that they came up with. Tell me if you sense any personal biases that may be influencing their projections. The very first scenario they presented is a true whopper. Let's just say they went hard out the gate. In a section titled A Feminist World 2091, women have usurped the United States, now holding 80% of high-up government, corporate, and academic positions. Science has progressed to the point that mothers can choose the sex of their babies, and because of the matriarchy, 10 girls are born for every 3 boys. Extreme feminist values and perspectives now dominate, and according to the report, quote,
values attributed by feminists to masculine thinking, such as abstract and analytical thinking, quantification, objectivity, rationality, straightforwardness, clarity, concision, universality, modernity, mastery, domination, repression, and technical manipulation have been discredited, along with male aggressive epistemological arrogance.
In the story, the feminist alternative Potash Corporation came across the WIPP site with hopes of digging for new resources. And they saw the monoliths that warned of radioactive danger, but rejected them as soon as they discovered the gender and racial makeup of those who designed the site. 97% old white men, with no evidence that any woman or person of color had contributed to the project. And so, due to their obvious bias in thinking, quote,
they decided that the warnings were simply another example of inferior, inadequate, and muddled masculine thinking.
The feminist corporation then drilled deep, looking for valuable ribbons of potash, and hit the storage container, releasing active radiation onto themselves and their man-hating society. The next scenario put out by the Southwest team was titled Mysticism and Religion, 2091, and it focused on a spiritual cult that they called the Marconian Conspiracy. This new religious movement believed that reality was not set in stone, that there were in fact many different realities tailor-made by each individual person, and the idea of objective scientific truth was something they rejected altogether. In fact, they blamed science and scientists for the majority of the world's ills. When one of the leaders heard a disembodied voice while exploring the Carlsbad Caverns, the group traversed the surrounding deserts of New Mexico, looking for the spot he claimed contained the meaning of life, written on scrolls and buried deep in underground capsules. When they came upon the WIPP site, they were able to ascertain the meaning of the warnings, but rejected them, even laughed at them, as a reality consensus of unenlightened, villainous scientists. And so, like the feminists, they dug until a geyser of nuclear waste exploded upward and contaminated their mortal coils. Another scenario involved New Mexico seceding from the U.S. to become a part of Mexico, and due to the split, the vital information about the WIPP site was lost. Folklore about the site remained, but the story got twisted, as legends sometimes do. Treasure hunters received funding from venture capitalists to look for buried treasure somewhere in the desert near Carlsbad. When they came across the warning markers, they believed them to be designed to scare people away from the riches that lie beneath, and so they dug deep, releasing the nuclear radiation onto themselves. But I do believe the venture capitalists made it out okay. Fast forward to the year 11,991, where they imagined a world of computerized people, a second class of humanoid robots who did most of the labor of society and were fighting for equal rights with natural-born humans. Suddenly, they're infected by a virus that causes them to drill and construct shafts compulsively, which they did outside Carlsbad without being able to heed the warning system. Kaboom. The contributors to the Sandia report wanted to create one positive future where the nuclear waste warning messages actually worked. Again, it's the year 11,991, and the WIPP site, instead of being hidden like an omen in the inaccessible desert, is honored by a massively popular museum and theme park in Roswell, New Mexico. Nearby, themed restaurants, themed hotels, and themed nuclear entertainments line the streets. The report states, people came from all over the earth to visit the WIPP Worlds and the WIPP Museum. No child's education was considered complete without at least a week there. They said the massive attraction would be founded in 2016 and that the WIPP Museum of Energy would teach the history of nuclear power, including its dangers, with dioramas, exhibitions, virtual reality, and holograms, while also educating the patrons about where the nuclear waste sites were still located. There would even be a bus tour out to the actual WIPP site, its warning markers meticulously maintained by the museum's staff and funded by the enormous income from the hugely popular attraction. But the impact of this museum culture was supposed to last for thousands of years after its own time in the same vein that it was created. So they deliberately spread folklore again, their own Disney-esque legend, complete with the memorable character of Nicky Nuke. Nicky Nuke, not specified as an animal or human or robot, is a heroic being dead set on carrying out his duty, warning people about the dangers of nuclear waste and keeping in the public consciousness the location of the repository. In the report, the museum commissions a series of children's books and poems, animated films and live theater productions, among many other pop culture contributions, in order to get Nicky Nuke and the lore around him to cement in the long-term zeitgeist. In this vision from the Southwest team, even after the museum had long closed and time had eroded the warning markers at the WIPP, Nicky Nuke remained as a mythic folk hero whose story did not degrade over time. In this version, the repository is never breached and the waste stays safely buried forever. After 10 years of multidisciplinary and international collaboration on theoretical ideas of the distant future and how to communicate with it, experts settled on a pretty boring final recommendation. Claiming that the process will be formally introduced to the government in 2028, we'll see, they decided the best course of action would be to create 32 granite monoliths, each 25 feet high, inside a giant earthen wall. All of this would surround an enormous room made of granite that contained the warnings and information in English, Spanish, Russian, French, Chinese, Arabic, and Navajo, as well as pictograms illustrating the dangers. Included would be blank parts of the wall where new languages could be added. There would also be several subterranean levels that would have to be passed through before hitting the actual location of the buried waste, vaults that contained more and more detailed information about what lay below. But all of this is still theoretical because we still don't have a permanent site ready to store all of our most deadly byproducts. Currently, nuclear waste is mostly stored in casks above ground near the sites of the reactors. Governments here and around the world, instead of focusing on 10,000 years in the future, have started to look at a scale of 100 years, assuming that by then we will have the technology to come up with a better long-term plan. And as we're forced to continue to address the growing climate change disaster, we are looking for alternative sources of clean energy. And since nuclear power has no carbon emissions, it's possible that we may be looking again at a nuclear future. This means that these big questions will continue to matter if we do indeed decide to care about our incomprehensibly distant future descendants. John Lumberg, an artist interested in nuclear semiotics, attended a conference in Sweden addressing the future of their own Forsmark repository. John told Vice in 2017, quote, When markings came up in the discussion at Forsmark, it was clear that they hadn't really heard much about what WIPP had done. The idea that we should go to these elaborate extremes to put a warning marker for people 10,000 years from now is something so crazy that only Americans would think of doing it. Finland, one of many other countries also trying to figure out what to do with their nuclear waste in the long term, has essentially taken the opposite approach. They plan to bury their waste in a facility deep underground, sealing it in steel and copper capsules that they estimate can contain radioactive material for 100,000 years. But they will not opt for a forest of granite thorns or biologically edited ray cats or manufactured folklore. Instead, they will simply bury it, let plants grow over it naturally, and leave no markers of any kind whatsoever. They believe that it's safer to hide it casually than to mark it with all the ominous flamboyance that we've discussed today, because for people like me, it will only entice us more. And besides, a society able to survive for 10,000 more years would likely be able to detect radiation. It's also worth saying that nuclear waste will not be as dangerous to the faraway future as these thought experiments have led us to believe. But still, it feels valuable to consider deep time for its own sake. The truth is, the first time I read the Wikipedia page about these long-term nuclear warning messages, I cried right there in the kitchen. It was weird. Whatever was going on, it felt like it was coming from a place deep inside me, almost like it was written into my very DNA, like the information plants we talked about. Specifically, it was those warning messages I read at the beginning of this episode that did it, ones that may eventually be included at the future WIPP site. The idea was that these warnings, written in every major language, would start off simple and grow increasingly more complicated, a kind of repetitive hand-holding through vital information. The messages put forth by the task force are strange, oddly painful, and hauntingly beautiful, reading to me like a long-lost poem. This place is a message and part of a system of messages. Pay attention to it. Sending this message was important to us. We considered ourselves to be a powerful culture. This place is not a place of honor. No highly esteemed deed is commemorated here. Nothing valued is here. What is here was dangerous and repulsive to us. This message is a warning about danger. The danger is in a particular location. It increases toward a center. The center of danger is here. Of a particular size and shape, and below us. The danger is still present in your time as it was in ours. The danger is to the body, and it can kill. The form of the danger is an emanation of energy. The danger is unleashed only if you substantially disturb this place physically. This place is best shunned and left uninhabited. There is a heartbreaking gravity contained in the odd syntax of these cautionary verses. The truth that in our time, we created and used weapons that decimated populations and could do so again. That those in power created a button that could destroy us all in a moment, and then buried the evidence that continued to be deadly deep underground. It seems that while imagining the future, we remember the present with shame. But still, we've tried to figure out ways to talk to the future, to warn them, to give them cautionary folk tales that will keep them safe from the bad things we've done. Of course, our show often deals with folklore and urban legends, but usually we aren't contemplating how to design these tales ourselves. And though it's far more likely that the government and the corporations that sponsored these reports cared mainly about assuaging the nuclear fears of Americans, those who put forth their ideas did so, I think, with a more genuine desire. Long-termism is an ethical view that claims we are inhabiting the Earth at a pivotal moment, what philosopher Derek Parfit called the hinge of history. Part of this pivotal moment, along with climate change and global political upheaval, is the fact that within the last century, we have created weapons that could annihilate the human race for the first time in all of human history. I can hear it now, a child 10,000 years in the future, wondering,
why did they do that?
Maybe they're hovering through that nuclear museum, holding a stuffed animal of Nicky Nuke, or playing an ancient macabre clapping game in some unknowable future language. Where the cats are green, the earth is mean, death comes to those who do not heed. Maybe they will know, despite all that we did in our time, that some of us wanted better for them, that we wanted peace for them. If we can, indeed, talk to the future, if podcasts are somehow preserved for thousands of years, I want to say that, even just in theory, I think of you. I hope there is beauty still left in your world. I hope you write poems to a second moon. I hope, against all odds, that you've created a place of honor. This was American Hysteria. If you want to support our show and help us keep going for 10,000 more years, you can go to patreon.com/American Hysteria or subscribe on Apple Plus. You'll get ad-free episodes, and you'll also get access to my other podcast that I do with our producer, Miranda, called Hysteria Home Companion, where we tell you stories that were either left out of the episode or ones we think that you'll really like. That's patreon.com/American Hysteria or subscribe on Apple Plus. American Hysteria is written, produced, and hosted by me, Chelsea Weber Smith. Our sound designer and assistant producer is Riley Swedelius Smith. Our producer and editor is Miranda Zickler. And our voice actor is Will Rogers, with a special guest appearance from his daughter, Zoe. If you go to AmericanHysteria.com, you can leave us a message on our Urban Legends hotline about a tale that you remember from growing up, and we just might do an entire episode about it. And you can also pick up some of our merch. That's AmericanHysteria.com. You can follow us on Instagram at American Hysteria Podcast. And if you have time, leaving us a 5-star review on the app of your choice really helps us out. Thanks, as always, for listening. And to all of you in the present moment, and to all of you 10,000 years in the future, I hope you have a great week.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.